Now, J.D., honey, I know it's been a rough couple of weeks, but everyone else seems to be happy for your grandma and me. Ruthie said that you don't deal with the change well.
You don't know me well enough. He interrupted me again, which was not doing much to warm my heart toward him.
I understand that you love your grandma and you're concerned for her well-being. I think that's admirable, Jade.
How horrible was it that I wanted to tell him he had it totally wrong? He reached out to pat my hand. His own was clammy and damp enough to make me want to pull away.
I just want you to know that I love your grandma, and I'm going to take care of her.
It's not her I'm worried about. Mama popped her head into the doorway again. Jane, could I see you in the kitchen for a minute? Daddy sent me a frantic look. Clearly, the idea of more alone time with the geriatric lovebirds had him panicked. Slinking out of the room, I muttered, "Everybody stops interrupting me, or I'll publish a newsletter featuring your secret thoughts of the day." Mama had heated all of the food. She'd also rolled the plastic picnic ware into paper napkins and filled all of the cups with ice. She was now organizing and reorganizing the Tupperware lids, first putting them on the containers, then tucking them under the containers. She was doing pointless busy work. Thinking back, I realized Mama rarely came out of the kitchen for the leftover Christmas dinners. "You're hiding in here," I accused. "You don't want to be in there any more than I do. You've been hiding in here for years."
"I have not,"
Mama cried, not meeting my gaze.
"Oh, it's over now. I've seen the man behind the curtain," I whispered. "I take no holiday guff from you from now on. Ever."
Mama ignored me while she fiddled with the defrost feature on the microwave. "Look, as much fun as it is trying to send secret warning messages to dead Grandpa Walking, I need to go." I looked at the clock. "It's getting close to 6, and I would like to avoid further awkwardness with Jenny."
"You're already here. Why don't you just stay?"
Mama wheedled.
"The boys haven't seen you."
"Since the funeral home last week," I said, "and they were too busy destroying the telephone-shaped Jesus Call Him Home floral arrangements to talk to me. I don't think my absence will scar them for life." The pounding arrival of the boys at the front door told me that I was too late.
"Grandma! Grandma! We got Blood Spatter Carjacker Mayhem 4!
Andrew shouted, waving the gore-soaked video game case at my mother.
"Can we play it now, please?"
"Oh, honey, you know Grandma doesn't have a game system," Jenny said, coming into the kitchen. She skidded to a stop when she saw me.
"Everything here is boring,"
Andrew sighed as he and Bradley slinked into the living room. If he had paid attention to the look on his mother's face, he would know that if he stuck around, it might get interesting. Or at least blood spattery. My brother-in-law, Kent, the chiropractor whom I've rarely heard speak, followed at Jenny's heels. The moment he saw me, he pivoted and trailed after the boys.
"I didn't know you'd be here,"
Jenny said, sending a reproachful look Mama's way.
"Mama, I agreed to see her at Bob's visitation, but that's it. You can't let her come over and not tell me. It upsets the boys to see her."
I rolled my eyes. The boys didn't even notice I was in the room. And if they did and you actually told them their aunt was a vampire, they'd probably think I was the coolest thing since Blood Spatter Carjacker Mayhem 4. And don't blame Mama. I didn't mean to stay so long, but I got caught up talking. I'm leaving now.
"Oh, but you can't go," Mama cried. "This is the first time we've all been in the house together since you..."
"Died," I finished for her. "You can say it. I died."
"Shh,"
Jenny shushed me, looking toward the den.
"Please, can't you both just put this all aside for the holiday?" Mama begged. "For the family?"
"No," Jenny and I chorused. Mama switched tactics just by dropping her voice an octave.
"Now, girls, this is just silly. We're a family, and it's Christmas. If you can't forgive your family around the holidays, what..."
"Stop," I told her. The way she stretched the word into family, when she wanted something, always set my teeth on edge. The time of year doesn't change anything. I don't want her around my family, Jenny ground out. I shot her a look that could have dropped a mere observant woman. So it was her family? As far as she was concerned, I wasn't part of it anymore. Frankly, she was welcome to it. I'm going.
Now, Jenny, be a good sister, Mama told Jenny. We have to have the whole family together for Christmas. The good Christian thing to do would be to...
She's dead, Jenny cried. The good Christian thing to do would be to give her a decent burial.
Now, Jenny, you know you don't mean that, Mama said through clenched teeth.
Burial talk is my cue to go, I said, grabbing my jacket. I think I'll be leaving the country for New Year's, so please don't call. I stuck my head into the den to give Daddy a quick goodbye, which he couldn't hear over the screeching and beeping of the boys' new radio-controlled monster trucks. From the kitchen, I heard Mama whine,
Tell Jane it just won't be Christmas without her.
You have me, Kent, the boys here, why? I closed the front door on Jenny's wounded response. I looked back through the window. Wilbur looked absolutely miserable. I was sympathetic, but when it came to the Jameson family Christmas, it was every man, woman, and vampire for themselves. Chapter 10 Adult werewolf children are expected to stay within the confines of pack territory. Those who move more than a 5-minute run from pack headquarters are either disowned or hosts to frequent weekend guests. Mating rituals and love customs of the were. From the dawn of time, women have formed friendships for one purpose only, to make sure they'll have someone to provide unpaid serf labor for their weddings. And we all just go along with it, spurred by fear that if we don't submit to the bridal demands, there will be no one to slave over our own weddings. That's why, 6 months before the actual wedding, I was spending an evening measuring and cutting exactly 14 inches of cornflower blue ribbon over and over and over and over. These ribbons would be sent to a printing company to be stamped with HMS Titanic on one side and Zeb and Jolene, Struck by Love, on the other. They would then be tied around old-fashioned hurricane lamps as part of Jolene's carefully planned tablescape. Each table was going to be named for famous, read deceased, Titanic passengers such as John Jacob Astor and Molly Brown, then decorated with hurricane lamps and fake ice. Of course, no one would pay attention to a seating plan, which is another Southern wedding tradition. Jolene had the gall to call this gathering a work party, in the style of Amish people who get together to make a quilt or build a barn. I didn't think Amish women typically had a camel hanging from the corner of their lips while they worked, like Jolene's Aunt Lulu. Also, the Amish employed more lenient leaders than Jolene, who had the tendency to become a little bossy when it came to her nuptials.
It has to be at least 14 inches to make sure each bow has about 3 inches of hanging ribbon on each side, Jolene told us.
I would have questioned whether Jolene was serious, but she didn't respond well when I laughed at her, All bridesmaids must cut their hair to exactly 3 inches below the shoulder by March, edict. Pointing out that the printing company would have cut these ribbons for an additional $250 would have resulted in huffy eye rolls from Jolene's battalion of cranky cousins. Besides, Aunt Vonnie, who had somehow heard my full opinion of the bridesmaids' dresses, was already giving me the dagger eyes. The McLean clan alpha couple, known to Jolene as Mom and Dad, lived in the main house on the compound, a quaint little yellow farmhouse with white shutters and a porch swing, surrounded by a series of increasingly dilapidated trailers. Inside, the walls were decorated with Thomas Kincaid prints and silk floral arrangements saved from funeral services. Everything was neat and clean and protected by doilies. And everybody was naked, which explained the doilies. Jolene and her cousins whipped their clothes off the moment they got in the door, the way most people kick off their shoes.
"Does this bother you?"
she asked the first time I stumbled into her mother's house. "I just don't know where to look," I said, settling for a strange orange silk flower arrangement mounted on the wall. The truth was, as the only clothed person there, I felt weird. I felt more naked than Jolene. The only cousin who was remotely friendly was Charlene, who had asked for my home and email addresses twice in the 4 hours since meeting me. She wanted to be my best friend. Seriously, my best friend. You cannot be nice to people like Charlene. It's like feeding a stray cat. The cat just keeps coming back until you have to move. So I was being overtly rude to her, which wasn't really helping my standing with the rest of the family. Fortunately, among werewolf women, the word bitch is not offensive. I was having a lot of fun with that. "Hey there, bitches," I called as I came through the door. "What are my favorite bitches up to today?" The only response was a chorus of unenthusiastic, drawled highs and hays. "I know what you're doing," Jolene muttered as she hugged me, "and it's not funny." "See, that's where you're wrong," I said, tucking wavy crimson hair behind her ears. She scowled at me. "I'll try to keep it to a minimum." Jolene was clearly the golden child in her clan. Her mother, Mimi, and all of the aunts fawned over her, telling and retelling cute stories from when she was a cub. Any accomplishment or news from the other cousins was matched with something about Jolene. Jolene was the only one of her cousins to attend community college. Jolene could skin a rabbit in 2 bites. Jolene was Miss Half Moon Hollow 1998. Jolene and Zeb would be the first couple in her family to plan an actual honeymoon to Gatlinburg, Tennessee, which was where you went when you couldn't afford to go to Florida, but wanted to be far enough away that your parents couldn't drop in on the wedding night.
"Jolene works at Uncle Clay's sandwich shop,"
Aunt Lola said, beaming beatifically at Jolene.
"He says all the customers just love her. She's so helpful, so sweet. She just makes everybody she meets so happy."
Raylene, Angeline, Lurline, and company let loose a collective sigh and synchronized eye roll. Sensing that the mob might be turning ugly, Jolene asked,
"How's the new job, Raylene?"
"Fine,"
Raylene said, her voice flat as she concentrated on cutting the ribbon without fraying it.
"Just fine?"
Jolene asked.
"I mean, it's got to be fun, right?"
Raylene shrugged. "Sure."
"Well, you've seen one, you've seen them all, right, Raylene?"
Angeline asked slyly.
"Angeline?"
Mimi growled. "Yes, literally."
"I just started as a cake decorator at the Sweet Tooth,"
Raylene explained.
"I specialize in adult cakes."
"Like Black Forest?" I asked. "That always seemed pretty grown up to me." I really missed Black Forest cake, or any kind of cake. I missed chocolate. Bah! I still can't believe the last food I ate was potato skins.
"No, Raylene makes cakes that look like..."
Aunt Tammy looked around as if there were spies lurking behind the lace curtains.
"Sex parts."
Raylene sighed.
"I make penis cakes."
Well, at least I knew what we were serving at the bachelorette party. "How does one get into the penis cake field?" I asked. "Where do you buy the cake pans for that?" Raylene stared at me, unsure whether I was teasing her or honestly interested. Sensing a lull in the conversation, Aunt Lola, Raylene's own mother, changed the subject back to Jolene.
"We're just all so excited about Jolene's wedding."
Lola sighed.
"We've all waited for this for just years now. And Zeb's such an... he's a sweet boy. Tell us again how he popped the question."
Arlene muttered,
"'Cause we haven't heard this story in almost an hour now."
Jolene obviously heard her cousin, but ignored her. To be fair, I had heard the story a few times myself.
"Zeb had this big plan with a restaurant and hiding the ring in a souffle,"
Jolene said, smiling dreamily.
"And then I stepped out my front door. He saw me all dressed up, and he blurted out, 'Will you marry me?' and shoved the ring at me. It was so cute."
Jolene cooed, looking down at the little diamond ring for which Zeb had plunked down 2 months of his teaching salary.
"He almost shouted at me when he proposed. He was supposed to have the waiters at Julian sing this cute little 'Will you marry me?' song.
Most of them are all in the high school swing chorus, and when we got to the restaurant and they found out we were already engaged, they were so mad they had missed their chance to perform. After that, Zeb was afraid to order the souffle. Who knows what they might have done to it?
Did he cry? Lurleen asked. I heard that human males cry at the drop of a hat.
The amazing thing about werewolves, who spend half their lives behind a human mask, is that they have terrible poker faces. It's part of that canine earnestness thing. For a brief second, a look of pure annoyance flashed over Jolene's perfect features. Lurleen smirked.
How's it going with Roy?
Jolene asked.
Isn't he the one that drives the ice cream truck?
There was that annoyed flash again, only on Lurleen's face.
That was Ray, Lurleen said, glaring. Roy and I aren't dating anymore.
Wait, didn't I see his name in the paper for something?
Jolene said.
Oh, he got busted for trying to sneak a brisket out of the Super Saver in his jacket,
Tammy said in the most helpful tone I'd heard in a while.
He would have gotten away with it if he hadn't dropped the brisket.
Oh, is he the one who yelled, "Who threw this meat at me?" and then tried to run out of the store? I giggled. Didn't it take 3 taser shots to get him down? Knowing that he's a werewolf now, well, that makes a lot more sense. I'm not helping, am I? I ducked my head and pretended that measuring ribbons exactly was the most important thing in the world.
So, Jolene, tell us all about your dress.
Aunt Dee Dee squealed.
I haven't seen it yet, but Bonnie said it's just gorgeous.
Cue another eye roll from the cousins. It is, I volunteered. Really gorgeous. Cue another eye roll. Sensing the shift in the tide, Jolene generously switched subjects to Braylene's son.
Mama finished Jake's little captain's outfit.
At my questioning eyebrow, she said,
Jake's going to be our ring bearer. We found a pattern for an authentic period captain's suit. I just hope he can get down the aisle without stripping it off.
Have you found a figurehead yet?
Aunt Tammy asked.
No, I'm thinking about having Uncle Deke carve one,
Jolene pouted. Titanic didn't have a figurehead. 3 guesses who said that. They all turned to me, the person who had dared to disagree with Jolene.
I know, Jolene shrugged, but it's just so nautical and romantic.
Actually, most figureheads on ships featured bare breasts because sailors believed that the best way to keep storms and misfortunes at bay was to have a woman sacrifice her dignity to the gods. Flash a little boob, get smooth sailing. It's not so much romantic as Clash of the Titans meets Girls Gone Wild. And if they weren't staring before, they certainly were now. I'm the only person in the room who knew that, aren't I? Jolene wrapped an arm around me.
I love it when you pretend to be normal.
Even when I was human, I wasn't normal, I admitted. I lowered my voice as the pack returned to their handiwork. So, what's Mama Ginger been up to lately?
Nothing,
she muttered.
That has me worried. It's been too quiet. Zeb says she's been distracted by hating your boyfriend, which is kind of nice. I know it can't last long, but I'm enjoying it while it lasts.
I think that's about as healthy as you can expect to be, I assured her. Mollified for a moment, Jolene measured out several lengths of ribbon, rolled it back on the spool, measured it again, rolled it back. Grunting, she yanked the entire length of ribbon off the spool in a heap of blue sateen. When she picked up the scissors, I gently took the ribbon out of her hand. Jolene, I may be going out on a limb here, but is something else bothering you?
Have you noticed anything odd about Zeb?
She asked.
I know this wedding stuff has him all stressed out, but he's just been so distant, like he doesn't even want to talk to me. And he's been kind of mean. Some of the things he's been saying are just hurtful.
When I gave her an intentionally blank look, she said,
like that joke about me not being very smart. And I don't think he realizes how much he talks about you. We'll be out to eat and he'll talk about what sort of food you used to like. We'll watch a movie and he'll say, I've already seen this with Jane. It's just hard, you know, like you're an ex-girlfriend, but you never really broke up with him.
I never really dated him either, I told her.
I know that, she said, nudging me with her arm. It's just hard to live up to you, Jane. No, it's not. You've already got me beat hands down on looks.
I know, she said, grinning.
Agree with me a little slower, please, I said, smacking her arm. And you can go out during the day, have kids, eat, tan, grow old with him. And Zeb loves you. He's just going through a weird phase. Just watch him at the wedding. He'll be the happiest groom ever. Jolene didn't look quite convinced, but mumbled, Okay.
The conversations became even more awkward as my night wore on.
This is just beyond the pale,
Gabriel grumbled as I opened my door for him. I'd been half-heartedly Googling Wilbur's name, hoping I could find some relatives I could warn about Grandma Ruthie's marital record before it was too late. Unused to Google failure, I was thrilled to have a distraction, even if that distraction was my agitated sire waving what looked like a ransom note at me.
I found this in my mailbox tonight,
he said, holding a slip of bright yellow paper with letters cut out of magazines and newspapers, the standard font for crazies. You're busting up a happy home. Break it off with Jane or else, I read aloud as he stormed inside. Mama Ginger's spelling is atrocious.
If you're to write harassing letters in upsetting type, you should at least have the courtesy to proofread,
he muttered, stretching across my couch.
Some people, I said, rolling my eyes. She did, however, ruin her anonymity by enclosing this,
he said, handing me a check for $352.67 from the account of Ginger and Floyd Lavelle.
I think she's trying to pay me to stay away from you.
What gave it away? I asked, holding up the check with a finger on the memo section where Mama Ginger had scribbled, To stay away from Jane.
Well, that is a lot of money, I said.
It was good while it lasted. Gabriel barked out a laugh.
I'm glad to see you, he said, before leaning across the cushions and kissing me.
I gave him a bemused smile and blithely ignored the fact that it had been almost a week since he'd called or visited, or that I'd been going crazy wondering where he was and what he was doing. But I didn't want to be that girlfriend and call his cell phone constantly. Instead, I said, I'm always right here. Gabriel opened his mouth to respond, but was interrupted by a knock at the door.
Maybe we shouldn't answer it, I said. It could be Mama Ginger. She might try to throw remaindered sausage products into the deal. I'm not going to hide from a middle-aged woman who cannot spell,
Gabriel insisted darkly, advancing on the front door. I held him back with a hand against his chest. Well, let me answer the door, at least. She's much less likely to douse me in battery acid. It was not a pleasant surprise to find Ophelia Lambert, the scary, forever adolescent head of the local panel for the World Council for Equal Treatment of the Undead, at my front door, wearing a man's shirt and tie with a skirt that might have been originally marketed as a headband. Ophelia oversaw my failed prosecution for several random killings and fires the previous year, and ultimately decided that I was justified in dusting Missy the Realtor with one of her own yard signs. Despite her being reasonably civil to me and electing not to set me on fire, I still found 300 years' worth of predatory grace wrapped up in a 15-year-old's body to be extremely off-putting. On her part, I think she found my convulsive antics charming, but she was afraid to admit it. I didn't do it, I blurted out after opening the door. Do what? She asked, her brow arched. Whatever, I said. Whatever big, suspicious badness brought you to my door. She smirked, her carefully painted coral lips quirking into a bow. Some people believe that the best way to avoid suspicion is not to declare their innocence before they're accused of anything. Well, I played it your way last time, and we see where that got me, I said, waving her inside. As I understand it, it got you a very nice triumph settlement, she said, slinking into the living room and perching on the nearest settee. She nodded in cool greeting to my sire.
So I keep hearing, I muttered. I'll believe it when I see a black balance on my bank statement.
Ophelia grinned, her fangs glinting from the low-burning firelight, and offered me a slip of paper. It was my bank statement, and the balance was black. Very, very black. Apparently, Missy's holdings had been transferred into my checking account. and her holdings were a little more extensive than I'd estimated. But it made sense, considering how many vampires she duped, cheated, and murdered to get their property. Plus, she did charge a healthy commission on her sales. I'd been raised to think of discussing money as vulgar and rude. So I'll just say that I would not have to worry about money. Ever. I could live the rest of my unnaturally long life sitting on a sofa stuffed with $20 bills, sipping dessert blood, and avoiding any form of effort, and I would still have a little left over to make sure my alma mater named a parking lot after me. I guess the council decided that I'd learned my lesson about being a good little vampire and staying out of trouble, I said. Something like that, Ophelia said, smirking again. The council couldn't legally hold on to the money any longer without charging me with something, I suggested. Something exactly like that. Ophelia grinned, delighted by my grasp of the situation. What do you plan to do with the money? I'm still in the yay I won't lose my house phase of processing this information, I told her. Give me some time. That's very normal, she said, shifting uncomfortably in her seat. Given the brevity of her skirt, it wasn't exactly comfortable for any of us. Out of deference to me and continued indifference to Ophelia, Gabriel made a comprehensive study of the window treatments. We will be getting back to a long discussion of how exactly you came by my account information, by the way, I said, avoiding eye contact with her lack of skirt. Can I ask you why you brought me this news in person? This sounds like the sort of thing that should be delivered by registered mail. I thought you were supposed to be a disinterested third party.
You interest me, she said nonchalantly. You're very entertaining.
Like a dancing monkey, I muttered. Ophelia smiled nastily, her bone-white fangs fully extended as she threw her head back and laughed. When she was done, she wiped her eyes and smirked at Gabriel.
Actually, I needed to see Gabriel as well. As much as I'd love to let you and your charming paramour return to whatever it was that you were doing, there's something I need to discuss with you.
Silence. I looked from the ancient teenager to my sire. Gabriel stared at Ophelia, who returned his silver gaze unmoved and unimpressed. Clearly, whatever it was, Ophelia was not going to talk about it in front of me. And neither of them seemed willing to ask me to leave. Apparently, that would be rude. Pretending I didn't exist, however, was totally okay. I'll just go check on something, I said, scurrying into the kitchen with as much dignity as possible.
All the way outside, Jane,
Ophelia called after me. Well, there goes that. I would like to say that I stood on the porch and enjoyed the pleasant evening air, contemplated the fullness of the moon and my place in the universe, giving not one thought to what was being said in my own house and how it might affect me. But I crept around to the front door and used my vampire hearing to eavesdrop. I'm a deeply flawed person. It should come as no surprise that I am not good with stealth. Ophelia and Gabriel obviously knew I was doing it because they spoke in hushed tones that I strained to hear. All I could make out were furious whispers, and Ophelia saying the words unhinged, nightmare, and Janine. There was that name again. Who the hell was Janine? I stepped closer to the door, catching the wrong porch board and sending an ear-splitting creak directly into their ears. They were now more than aware that I was standing outside listening. Ophelia snickered and said in a louder voice, "This is your problem to deal with, Gabriel. But if you cannot handle the situation, the council would be happy to step in." I could hear Gabriel's insistent, almost desperate whisper in return, but I could not understand his response. I think he was speaking Chinese. I could only speak bad high school Spanish. Ophelia, clearly exasperated at his pretense, responded with a rather impressive tirade that I could not understand. But then again, everything sounds sort of angry in Mandarin. Realizing that further listening was pointless, I spent the next few minutes tossing a beloved but much abused tennis ball to Fitz. He was in hyper-doggy heaven, running at me and making playful nips at my jeans. I heard the front door open and watched with dread as the ecstatic, "New person!" expression flashed in Fitz's eyes. I could hear myself yelling, "No!" in slow motion as Fitz ran at Ophelia. My brain had just enough time to calculate exactly how much time I would be spending in the council clink if Fitz ruined one of Ophelia's indecently expensive outfits, or, Worse yet, if Ophelia would leave Fitz with all of his appendages intact. Instead of the canine carnage I foresaw, I was shocked as Ophelia smiled warmly at my loping mutt. She held up one finger and said something soft in German. Fitz skidded to a halt directly in front of her and plopped obediently on his butt. She smiled again and gave another command. Fitz held up his paw, and she deigned to take it, scratching him behind the ears with an expression of... Well, it was the first genuine expression I'd ever seen on Ophelia's face, so I can only describe it as young. For a moment, the sentries fell away, and she was just a beautiful girl standing on my lawn, petting my dog. I'm pretty sure my jaw was resting on my chest because when Ophelia looked up at me, all traces of the young human faded like smoke. Her face hardened into more familiar lines. She narrowed her eyes at me. I raised my hands in defense. I didn't see a thing, I promised her. She arched her eyebrow, gave Fitz one last pat on the head, but said nothing. Gabriel came out the front door, leaning against the porch post as Ophelia made her way toward her sporty red Corvette. I'm sure the act of driving that down Main Street made her an object of obsession and envy, but frankly, I found it rather obvious in terms of jailbait appeal. Ophelia opened the door, tilted her head, and considered me for a moment, her piercing blue eyes glowing at me through the shadows. I am very glad that Missy's money has landed in your hands. I think you're going to do far more fascinating things with it than some tawdry housing development. So now isn't the time to tell you about the Dracula theme park I have planned for the back 50 acres? I asked brightly. Gabriel snickered but covered it with a hearty clearing of the throat. For both our sakes, I'm going to assume that was a joke. She muttered, climbing into her car and giving us one last flash of thighs. Ophelia departed, leaving my head spinning with the possibilities of Missy's money. I would never have to worry about paying the property taxes. I would be able to keep the house up for centuries to come. The early family legacy, such as it was secure. I could travel. I could finally see all of the places I'd dreamed of seeing all my life. Edinburgh, Tahiti, Beijing. Granted, I would have to see them at night, but still, I could go. I would just have to talk to Gabriel about safety precautions and passport issues for the undead. I could adopt one of those orphans on TV who make you feel so guilty. Hell, I could adopt a whole family. I would donate a catalog full of children's and young adult books to the library. I could secure funding for the Half Moon Hollow High School's computer lab. The students were still using Commodores. I would have to do all of this anonymously. You wouldn't believe how quickly relatives come out of the woodwork when money comes into play. Lottery wins bring out kin you never knew existed, and they all have inventions to invest in, trailer payments to be made. My cousin Glory, who was, sadly, male, won a $10,000 scratch-off once, and within 12 hours, our great-uncle Stuart had moved his camper onto Glory's driveway. Of course, if my family found out I had money, I'm pretty sure I would die in a mysterious window treatment accident, and Jenny would immediately claim it as my next of kin. And given my last couple of months, death by Venetian blinds was becoming more likely. Note to self. Write a will. Leave everything to Zeb. I squealed and hopped into Gabriel's arms, wrapping my legs around his waist. Fortunately, he did not drop me. You are now dating a very well-off woman, and I know it would be against your gentlemanly principles to ask just how well-off, and it's even further against my own good character to tell you, but let me put it this way. If you ever run into financial trouble, you don't have to worry. That's sweet, but unnecessary, he said, pulling me against him. Maybe I'll let you be my cabana boy, I sighed. I will not dignify that with a response. He chuckled, but held me to his chest with a sort of quiet desperation, pulling me so close that breathing would have been an issue if I needed oxygen. Obviously, his conversation with Ophelia had upset him more than he was letting on. Was this Janine an old girlfriend? A current girlfriend? What sort of situation would require the council to step in and interfere? As Gabriel clung to me, I stroked his hair, knowing that no matter what I said or asked, it wouldn't make either of us feel any better. So I let him hold me and pretended that everything was fine. It was the loneliest I'd ever felt in his presence. Chapter 11. Over the past 100 years, female wares have embraced certain human mating rituals. Werewolf males who neglect to present their mates with meat or floral offerings on a birthday or anniversary can expect to sleep in an actual doghouse. Mating rituals and love customs of the were. I was a little nervous about what vampires get each other for Valentine's Day because, as far as I knew, it could involve actual hearts. So, when I found a white box on my doorstep, tied with a huge red bow, I went into full-on spastic girly-girly mode. There was squealing. A lot of squealing. For just a minute, the inside of my head was like a living Lisa Frank poster. The contents were unexpected. For one thing, I didn't know whether Gabriel was actually going to be in town on Valentine's Day, and second, I'm usually a white cotton panties kind of girl, occasionally a black cotton panties kind of girl. But if Gabriel was game for the red satin bustier thing, I could give it a try. Yes, giving your girlfriend naughty lingerie for Valentine's Day is tired and cliche, and I've spent years railing against the commercialism and crassness of a holiday designed by corporate America to compel men to buy their way into a lady's affections and make single women feel pathetic and alone. Of course, at the time, I was pathetic and alone, so pardon me for taking the opportunity to feel smug for a day. Gabriel's gift was a modern twist on the classic Victorian corset. Buttery, soft satin in a perfect Valentine's red, stretched over whalebone. It was some sort of miracle underwear, cinching my waist into a tiny point and giving me anatomically improbable cleavage, all without cracking my ribs. The hem of the bustier just barely skirted a pair of satin briefs, which were connected to a pair of lacy black stockings with the thinnest of red silk ties. I struck a languorous pose in the mirror and, despite looking pretty damned hot, if I do say so myself, felt a little ridiculous. I looked like a cover model for the romance paperbacks my mother read. All I needed was a title like The Tempestuous Schoolmarm, spelled out over my head in an over-curlicued font. Still, I slinked around the house and lit the vanilla candles. I wanted to build some ambiance for Gabriel to appreciate before I jumped him. My home was considerably more welcoming than it had been the last time he visited. I hadn't had disposable income in a while, so after months of scrimping and saving and buying generic market brand blood, I went into a sort of online shopping fit. I bought blackout curtains for every window in the house, a new comfy couch, a bigger fridge. I even booked a prefab contractor to come out and attach the house to the garage with a covered walkway. It was like baby-proofing for someone with fangs. I was feeling adored and very in touch with my inner sex kitten when he showed up at my door later that night. "Someone earned himself a very nice Valentine's Day dinner," I purred, leaning against the door frame. In case you didn't notice, dinner was in special, naughty, secret-meaning quotation marks. Gabriel stared at me, his expression blank. I liked to think it was the barely-there black dress I was wearing over the lingerie hindering his neurological processes, but no. The lingerie, the red satin thing with little garters. I watched his face go from blank to thunderous. Judging from that expression, you have no idea what I'm talking about, do you? My stomach seemed to ripple as I squirmed in the suddenly icky red undergarments. Oh, not good. I started down the stairs, then turned on him, hands on hips. "Wait, what did you send me for Valentine's Day?" His face was set in grimmer lines, but for a totally different reason. "Valentine's Day? Commemorating the martyrdom of St. Valentine? Patron saint of beekeeping, epileptics, and greeting card manufacturers?" I said. There was a beat of silence where I was smacked in the head with a clue by four. "You didn't get me anything for Valentine's Day, did you?" Gabriel cleared his throat.
"Valentine's Day was not something we recognized in my day."
I poked him in the chest. First of all, yes it was. Lacy cards and love tokens were widely exchanged, even in Victorian times. By now you should know better than to screw with me on historical trivia. Also, you've had 140-something years to adjust. get with the program. You didn't notice the giant hearts and paper cupids hanging off every stationary object?
I've never dated a modern woman before.
I poked him again. You can only use that as an excuse so many times. And don't offer to give me awesome sex as a present, because I think we've established that given the right circumstances, I can hurt you.
I wasn't going to.
I narrowed my eyes at him. Instead of finishing that ill-fated protest, he said,
"Let's focus on the creepy anonymous gifts."
You don't say creepy. Don't try to get in good with me by talking like me. I just don't understand how someone could select a pitch-perfect girlfriend Christmas gift and then completely ignore Valentine's Day.
Well, what did you get me?
You will never, ever know, I promised him, and he wouldn't. Because now that I'd made such a big deal about it, boxer shorts with little glow-in-the-dark vampire lips and fangs all over them didn't seem that great.
Let me see the gifts you did get, he said. You were going to show me.
I crossed my arms over my chest. Not now, I'm not.
Jane.
Fine. I slid the straps off my shoulders and let the dress pool at my feet. Gabriel's eyes went wide as he scanned me from head to toe. Gabriel?
Give me a moment. All of the blood just drained out of my head.
I find this whole thing to be incredibly gross now that I know I'm wearing some stranger's undies. I shuddered and shrugged out of the suddenly disturbing getup. And now I was naked and embarrassed, which was a sensation I was much more familiar with. The phone rang.
Saved by the bell,
he muttered. If we had time, I'd tell you about that figure of speech's origin in connection to grave digging, but I'm not going to, I said, picking up the phone. No gift means no trivia.
And yet somehow I think I'll survive, Gabriel groused.
I gave him a meaningful look as I barked a greeting into the phone. A sly, female voice asked,
Did you like the presents?
Who is this?
It's Andrea.
The voice on the other end of the line sounded hurt. Hi, I can't talk right now, I whispered. Gabriel's eyes narrowed at the stress in my voice and language that, after I thought about it, sounded awfully suspicious.
I'll call you later.
What's wrong? She asked. I turned away from Gabriel and tried to lower my voice even further, but let's face it, my boyfriend had super hearing.
I can't really explain. Let's just say the words Happy Valentine's Day are probably going to make my eye spontaneously twitch for years to come,
I grumbled as Gabriel stared at me, his expression annoyed and somehow helpless.
What happened?
Andrea cried.
I don't want to talk now,
I told her through gritted fangs as Gabriel took a subtle but deliberate step toward me, his ear cocked toward the phone. I shot him a venomous look and started into the next room.
But I left that package on your front porch to help things along. Seriously, that outfit was flawless. Practically a foolproof recipe for the perfect first Valentine's Day as a couple. How could you screw this up?
Andrea cried, using that tone my mama used when I'd butchered a recipe.
That was you?
I demanded, keeping my voice low.
What? Why? What?
You and I are going to have a serious discussion about boundaries. What the hell were you thinking? Her voice lowered to a slightly more contrite level.
Well, I've known Gabriel for a while, and he's just not the type of guy who puts a lot of stock in relationship milestones like a first Valentine's Day. I knew you would freak out and read a lot into it if he looked as if he forgot. And I knew he wouldn't ask for help or accept advice on what to get you, so I thought I'd help you out. I thought he'd be so thunderstruck at the sight of you in simply stunning underwear that you wouldn't have time to talk about where it came from.
If she wasn't so depressingly right, it would really piss me off that Andrea had managed to figure out my relationship before I did. No, wait, I was pissed anyway. We have got to get you dating again because you clearly have too much time on your hands, I told her. This is not normal behavior.
It's very normal behavior to want to have your friend have a nice Valentine's Day. What's not normal is you somehow turning this into some Jane disaster. Hell, even your Grandma Ruthie knows to buy lingerie on Valentine's Day. I saw her at Victoria's Secret the other night. She said she was getting something special for her fiancé. I thought her fiancé died.
Oh, my God! Why are you making this worse? I cried. I didn't know whom I felt more sorry for at that point, myself or poor, unsuspecting Wilbur. I do not need that image in my head, and as much as I appreciate your intentions, don't ever do this again. It's weird. Wait. Wait, if you thought we would be all naked and blissful by now, why are you calling? I asked, ignoring the way Gabriel's eyebrows shot up at that comment.
Well, even vampires have a recovery period.
I scrunched my nose. Ew! That's a conversation ender. I'll call you later. I hung up the phone and turned on Gabriel. I'm going to take a shower. Maybe you shouldn't be here when I get out. Leaving a trail of discarded lingerie in my wake, I stomped toward the bathroom. I turned the water to the white-hot range, slid into the shower, and fought back tears. Oh, how was I mortified. Let me count the ways. 1. I put on strange underwear collected from my doorstep without knowing whom it was from or what they could have done to it. 2. My boyfriend blew off Valentine's Day. 3. My girlfriend was so sure this might happen, and rightly so, that she provided me with a pity present to get me laid. 4. I had images of a teddy-clad Grandma Ruthie doing some sort of fan dance in my head. And 5. My boyfriend blew off Valentine's Day. I thought that bore repeating. I soaped my hair, deliberately avoiding the almond-scented anti-frizz shampoo Gabriel liked in favor of plain old Pantene. I heard the bathroom door open. Gabriel came in and sat on the bathroom counter.
Jane, we've talked about this, he said softly. I'm your sire and your lover. My bond to you is very strong. I won't share you with another man, even if he does have impeccable taste in lingerie.
That was sort of a confession of love, right? I snapped the shower curtain open, glaring at him through the soap bubbles slipping down my face. Why is it that your first assumption is that it's another man? What about me makes you think I would cheat on you? Then I snapped the curtain closed. Somehow his voice lowered even further, his tone worn thin.
I don't know if I can make you happy, Jane. That makes me sick inside. I see the regrets you have. I see the longing in your eyes when you talk about your life before, the things you miss. I don't know if I'm good for you. There are times when I wonder if you're really happy as a vampire, whether you wish I'd never met you that night, if some part of you would be happier as a human.
This time I slung the curtain so hard the rings popped off the curtain rod.
Well, of course some part of me would be happier as a human, you dumbass, I yelled.
For one thing, I wouldn't spontaneously combust when I wanted to, say, take a walk before sunset. I wouldn't have to put up with my mother's undead denial issues. I wouldn't have to worry about people shrinking away every time I walk into a room. And I'd be able to eat. I haven't eaten in months. Do you realize that? No carbs, no fats, no chocolate, nothing. I mean, do you know what it's like for someone like me not to be able to get chocolate?
Gabriel was obviously unprepared for the level of anger or volume in this wet, naked outburst. Looking slightly dazed, he closed what was left of the curtain. He was barely audible over the sound of the shower spray.
I'm sorry. I didn't realize you were so miserable.
I'm not miserable, but I'm not completely happy as a vampire, and it's not fair for you to expect me to be. If you want a real, honest relationship, I can't put on a happy, fanged face for you. Were you thrilled with your new life after you returned?
No, but my family did tie me naked to a tree to wait for the sunrise, he pointed out calmly. We're straying from the point.
I stuck my head under the rapidly cooling spray.
Which is? That another man is sending you underwear.
I could let him keep wondering, I mused, rolling my eyes. I could let Gabriel think I had a secret admirer, make him jealous. After weeks of wondering where he was, what he was doing, whom he was with, he deserved it. But I'd never been that girl, the game player, the girlfriend who played by asinine rules laid out in the self-help book of the week. And even though it would probably make me feel better, I don't think Gabriel pushing a tree on top of some poor guy he suspected of being my suitor would help our relationship.
It wasn't another man, I huffed. It was Andrea.
There was a heavy silence on the other side of the curtain. That wasn't something I was prepared for. I thought maybe it was Zeb.
Ew!
I cried. Well, he's been acting so strange lately, Gabriel protested. And I don't see how Andrea giving you sexy underthings is any less disturbing. I don't think anyone should be buying you sexy underthings but me.
Well, you didn't.
I cut the water off and snapped the curtain open. I pushed past him and snatched a towel. He grabbed my hand and pulled me to eye level with him.
Andrea felt the need to step in for you. Instead of assuming the worst, you could just talk to me, Gabriel,
I said as he followed me into my bedroom. I yanked open a dresser drawer and pulled out my flannel cow pajamas.
Not the cow pajamas, Jane, please. There's no reason to let this ruin our evening,
he groaned.
I'm sorry.
Beg pardon? I asked, cupping my hand around my ear. What was that?
You heard me, he grumbled. With our hearing, it's impossible for you not to have heard me.
No, I don't believe I did, I said, because I'm sure the master of poise could not possibly have just apologized to little old me.
Smugness is not attractive on you, Jane.
Smugness is one of my best features, I retorted, backing him against the footboard of my bed. I'm really, really good at it.
I've noticed, he muttered, nuzzling his nose along my jawline.
Laughing, he slipped his hand through my hair and kissed my temple. I shrugged him off.
Hey, I'm still mad at you, Valentine's Day skipper. You are going to be punished, and not in the fun way.
I acquiesce to your demands, he said solemnly.
He nodded at my bovine sleepwear.
Now I think you should take this off.
I snorted.
Not going to happen, my friend.
And it didn't. Instead of hot Valentine's Day sex, I made Gabriel paint my toes lavender. He has incredibly steady hands, while we watched the most dreaded of all chick flicks, Sleepless in Seattle. I would say he learned his lesson, but I caught him wiping his eyes toward the end.
Are you crying? I asked.
No,
he exclaimed.
I snickered and patted his shoulder.
It's just, it was so unlikely, the two of them showing up at the Empire State Building at the same time after missing each other so often and...
Do you want to sleep over?
I asked suddenly.
Will I have to sleep on the couch?
No, you can sleep in the guest room, I said sweetly as I secured the blackout curtains.
I'd rather make a run for my house,
he muttered.
I pulled back the comforter for him.
Fine.
He grinned and stripped down to his slacks. As a habit, Gabriel didn't wear underwear. I guess he wasn't feeling secure enough in my good humor to sleep in the nude. He fluffed the pillows on both sides of the bed and flopped down in giddy anticipation.
What's with you?
I'm just excited, he said, grinning.
I rolled my eyes as I reached for the bedside lamp. Just for the record, this is my first co-ed sleepover since Zeb and I were in fifth grade. And even then, Mama made Zeb sleep on a different floor of the house. I'm the spoonee, by the way. You are the spooner.
I don't spoon, Gabriel said.
Well, now you do, I told him, wrapping his arms around my waist. You don't snore, do you?
I don't breathe.
Good point. It was nice to know that our bodies still fit together perfectly outside the sexual arena. Gabriel rested his head on my shoulder, drawing my back against his chest and his knees under my knees. We lay in silence, and I burst out laughing.
What?
Gabriel asked.
Am I not doing the spooning right?
No, it's great, I giggled. But sunrise is not for another 4 hours. We're basically going to bed at the equivalent of 2 p.m. We've officially become the least interesting people we know, and considering that we drink blood and burst into flame when we tan, that's sort of sad.
You're saying the magic's gone?
Gabriel said.
Yep.
Well, it was nice while it lasted.
Gabriel released me and started climbing out of bed.
I'll be going now.
Okay, well, keep in touch. I clasped his hand. It was nice knowing you.
Thanks. You too.
I yanked his hand, forcing him back into the bed and rolling over me. He kissed me to show me exactly how boring we were.
I'm sorry I ruined your Valentine's Day,
he murmured against my neck, his voice soft on my skin.
I didn't know it was so important to you.
Well, you do now. You've been put on notice. I'm glad we're sleeping together, he said.
Of course you are, I snorted. You have a Y chromosome.
I mean sleeping as in resting, he said, pulling me flush against him. It's very intimate.
I never should have let you watch Sleepless in Seattle, I moaned. I've ruined you.
Gabriel did not snore, nor did he squirm around or steal covers, which made him a far more considerate bedmate than Fitz. At dusk, I could feel the sun fading as I rolled against the contours of his side. It was sweet to wake up next to him, to see his face relaxed and his mouth hanging open. Everything was still, quiet. I slipped my hand around his back and snuggled my face into his neck. It was oddly cool. I inhaled deeply, trying to memorize the scent of sleep on his skin, soft and clean and sweet. I closed my eyes and swallowed against the rising sensation in my chest, a mixture of happiness that I'd finally arrived at this place in my life and fear that it would be over soon. I was even less experienced at long-term relationships than I was at decent sex. And what did I really know about either? Pledging your eternal love took on a whole new meaning when you actually lived forever. What if Gabriel got bored with me? What if he woke up, in both senses of the word, and realized that I was really the same boring librarian under the fancy new fangs? What if Janine was the last vampire girl he'd cast off? Or worse yet, the vampire girl he was planning to be with once he cast me off? These were heavy thoughts to have at vampire dawn. The noise of the gears turning in my head must have jarred Gabriel awake because he stirred next to me, pulling on the front of my cow pajamas until I was flush against his chest.
Morning, he rumbled.
Morning, I whispered into his neck. You sleep with your mouth open.
I learn something new from you every day, he murmured, kissing my temple and stroking my back.
He pulled me under him. I felt boneless, liquid, more relaxed than I'd been in weeks. I belonged here. I was wanted. I didn't even worry about morning breath when Gabriel pressed his lips to mine because technically neither of us had breath at any time of the day. The remnants of my unhappy thoughts still haunting me, I took the time to run my fingertips along his long, sinewy limbs, his smooth, pale skin. I cupped my palms around his cheeks, lazily tracing the line of his bottom lip with my thumb. I was almost beyond caring when Gabriel peeled my pajama top over my head.
I hate these pajamas,
he muttered, tossing them over the edge of the bed.
The pajamas must go.
The pajamas stay, I told him. He arched his eyebrows, making me giggle. Well, not at the moment, obviously. He snickered, pushing the bottoms down to my ankles with his feet. He tucked his fingers between my hips and the waistband of my panties and tugged. The cotton buckled and tore, laying in a frayed heap next to my pajamas.
What do you have against my panties?
I moaned, mourning the loss of yet another pair. He smirked, casting a glance to where he was brushing against my wet, willing flesh.
Well, I think that should have been fairly obvious.
I was still laughing when he slipped inside me. I stretched my arms above my head, gripping the headboard as he trailed kisses down my chest, increasing his pace. The deeper he drove, the tighter I held on, until I ripped the wood spokes out of the frame. I gasped, horrified at what I'd done to a family heirloom. And then I just gasped, lost in the waves of sensation that threatened to drag me under. When I came to, I still had the hunks of wood clutched in my hands. Gabriel looked vaguely guilty.
We made it to a bed,
he offered meekly. And then we destroyed it, I moaned. But it was worth it. He pulled me onto his chest, pushing my hair out of my face before pulling me close. It's kind of weird to see Mr. Big Bad Vampire being all cuddly, I chuckled. It kind of destroys your mystique.
I haven't had a lot of good soft things in my life, he said against my forehead. Not since my family sent me away. Apart from being your sire and feeling that pull to you, it's that goodness, that softness and warmth, along with the resolve and strength in you that I love. Being turned hasn't taken that from you. If someone were going to design the perfect mate for me, it would be you. Even when you infuriate me with your pig-headed stubbornness and your temper and incredible lack of anything resembling self-preservation.
Stop describing me, please.
You're the most fascinating, maddening, adorable creature I've ever met, he said, sighing and pushing my hair out of my eyes. So when I seem possessive or I'm raving like a lunatic, it's just that part of me is still very afraid that I'll lose that. That I'll lose you. I love you.
That's such a normal boyfriend thing to say. I'm so proud, and yet a little freaked out.
Stop joking and listen to me, he said. I'm being serious.
So am I objected. That was a very normal thing for a boyfriend to say. He grinned down at me.
Does that mean I'm your boyfriend?
Oh, my lord, this is such a juvenile conversation to have with a 150-year-old man. I groaned. Yes, Gabriel, I would like you to be my boyfriend. I think we should go steady. I don't want to be with any other vampire but you. I love you, idiot.
We need new nicknames for each other, he said.
When I shoved at his shoulders, he grinned.
I haven't loved anyone in a long time, and I'm glad it's you. I'm glad I met you on the worst day of your life.
Well, you certainly made it more memorable. Chapter 12. Bachelorette parties are less about celebrating the bride's acquisition of a husband and more about making the female relatives feel vindication after the wedding planning process. Mating rituals and love customs of the wear. When we were kids, Zeb and I used to spend post-sleepover mornings eating Cap'n Crunch and watching the Smurfs. Somehow I didn't think Gabriel would appreciate the same routine. I padded into the kitchen, still clad in flannel cows, and warmed up a healthy breakfast of donated type A. Gabriel let Fitz out to snag the evening edition of the Half Moon Herald from the end of the driveway. Unfortunately, Gabriel overestimated Fitz's capabilities and had to get the paper himself. We climbed onto the porch swing to sip blood and read the happenings in the Herald while Fitz gambled around the yard chasing his own tail. It was strangely domestic, with the exception of finding another package on my doorstep. We were both relieved that it was just the genealogical information Daddy had found on Mr. Wainwright's family. Despite my library background, my strength tends toward database research, whereas Daddy excels with the dusty old book routine. After Mr. Wainwright lamented his lack of family history, I'd asked Daddy to use his mojo. Gabriel left for some council meeting, and I ripped into the research without bothering to change out of my pajamas. Daddy had done an impressive job. He found copies of Mr. Wainwright's old high school pictures from Half Moon Hollow Public School archives and an old newspaper clipping announcing Gilbert Wainwright's engagement to Bridget Brannigan, a girl he met while traveling in County Cork. Daddy found Mr. Wainwright's parents' marriage certificate and both of their obituaries. Searching through old records kept in the courthouse basement, records Daddy accessed through a school chum named Dieter, who worked there as a night janitor, Daddy found the origins of the Wainwright family. Gilbert Wainwright's father, Gordon Wainwright, was the son of Albert Wainwright, son of Eugenia Wainwright, a laundry woman who had worked on the Cheney family farm. She had Albert in 1879, but drowned a short time later during the town's inaugural 4th of July picnic down at the riverfront. Eugenia was unmarried, and there was no father listed on the birth certificate for young Albert. Albert was sent to an orphanage and raised there until he ran away at age 10. According to a book Daddy found in the library's special collections called The Hollow Frontier, Albert worked at the railway station and eventually took a job on a barge traveling the Ohio River before returning home to the Hollow in the 1920s. He was known for opening one of the first successful saloons in the Hollow, the one my great-grandmother burned. While water-stained and crumbling, the book contained a copy of a tintype of Albert.
Oh, man, I breathed, startled by Albert's face.
I flipped to Daddy's research on Eugenia, whom one of the groundskeepers at the Cheney farm described as a big, buxom piece of woman. I flipped back to the picture of Albert, who bore a striking resemblance to Dick. The same light, laughing eyes, the same devilish smile, the same long, patrician nose. But Albert looked to be at least 15 years older than Dick had been when he was turned. I checked the date on the photo and did some quick math in my head, then groaned. Dang it. I sat at the specialty books counter, drumming my fingers compulsively against the glass. Mr. Wainwright was puttering in the back, tossing his way through the reference section I'd just spent the better part of 2 days cataloging. Knowing that my nephew Andrew had a birthday coming up, he insisted that a tome entitled A Pop-Up Dictionary of Demons would be a perfect gift. I was inclined to agree with him because it might make Jenny swallow her tongue. In a rare show of discretion, I didn't mention my discovery to Mr. Wainwright. I wanted to surprise him somehow, and I didn't think blurting it out as soon as I opened the door would fit the occasion. The front doorbell tinkled, and I turned to find Mr. Wainwright's long-lost great-granddaddy standing at the counter with a scowl on his face.
"Well, Jane, you crook your little finger, and I come running," Dick said, clearly in a very grumpy mood. "Seems I'm always running after women who aren't interested."
"Andrea turned you down again, huh?" He made a sour face. The more I stared at him, the more I saw a resemblance to Albert, and for that matter, to Mr. Wainwright. My employer had a smaller build and more delicate features, but the same tilting smile, the same green, twinkling eyes. I was a little ashamed that I'd missed it. "Well, we could reminisce about the girl who didn't get away," I offered. "Dick, do you remember a woman named Eugenia? She used to work at your house."
"Yes," he said.
His lips quirked at a memory I wouldn't touch with a 10-foot pole, then locked into a completely un-Dick-like grimace. "Did you know that she left your employ because she got pregnant out of wedlock and that she drowned about 6 months after giving birth to the..." He refused to meet my gaze, looking to the left. "You already know, don't you?" I said. "You know about the baby, about Albert. You know." "What are you... who told you? How..." He spluttered. "Which question do you want me to answer first?" I asked, cringing.
"Jane, you need to stay out of this," he whispered darkly. "Just forget you ever found any of this. Don't say a word to Gilbert."
"But why?" I asked. "Why not just tell him? I think he would be thrilled to know he had a family. I love him, but I'm not related to him. He loves talking to you. I saw you together at the Christmas party."
"Stop,"
Dick said, grabbing my shoulders and covering my mouth with his hand as he cast panicked glances at the rear of the shop.
"You're meddling in something you have no part in. Whatever good deed you think you're doing here, just stop. This is none of your business. But just butt out, Jane."
The bell clattered to the floor as he slammed the door behind him. Mr. Wainwright, disturbing pop-up book in hand, hobbled up to the counter.
"Was Dick here? I thought I heard his voice."
I shook my head. Just some guy who insisted that we were, in fact, the adult video store next door. He was very upset by our limited selection. Mr. Wainwright laughed, handing me the book.
"Maybe we..."